Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. First, I want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I also want to tell you about what's coming up in July. Our team at Responsive want to invite you to participate in 6 hours of online CFRE-approved training. I am talking about a soup-to-nuts fundraising philosophy that will ensure your organization is ready for the road ahead. No one on the planet is going to offer you tools as researched, as tested, and as sustainable as our four frameworks. If you'd like more information about partnering with OneCause, or more information about our upcoming webinar series, look for information in the show notes. After you do, shoot me an email and let me know that you did. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Rachel. Thank you for being my guest yet again. We talked earlier this week, and we were talking about sort of where COVID-19 had sort of gotten us and some of the lessons that you felt like we were learning in the fundraising space. And now we're going to talk about where you think it's taking us in the future. But before we do that, for those who were not with us earlier this week, Rachel, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. My name is Rachel Muir, and what I do for a living is train people to be better at their fundraising. You can learn more about me at rachelmuir.com. It's rachelmuir.com. I've spent my whole career in fundraising. I refer to myself as a recovering executive director. I have literally worked every job in fundraising that is the Rubik's Cube of fundraising. I started a nonprofit in my hometown of Austin, Texas, to empower girls in math, science, engineering, and technology, and learned everything I know about fundraising in the trenches, just like you guys.
So, Rachel, we didn't talk about this in the last episode, but I did know a little bit about your work as the founding executive director for that organization. So I'm the husband of a very progressive, staunchly feminist woman. And we have two daughters who we want to grow up and be very independent and strong and speak their mind and all that sort of stuff. I have a 15-year-old daughter who is growing up in the Trump era. So what is Rachel Muir going to tell my daughter? I'm genuinely interested in that before we tackle our topic.
Yeah, gosh. Well, I have a 13-year-old daughter I'm raising in a Trump era. Right. I have a 13-year-old son. I have twins. I just do everything I can to encourage my daughter to speak her mind and be brave and be fearless and never take responsibility for, you know, how other people's interpretations or make excuses or apologies or apologize for herself. Yeah. I mean, it's a journey. It's it's a constant process to raise brave, strong, fearless kids, honestly, especially girls.
Yeah. My wife and I have talked a lot of, her name's Christina, and we've talked a lot about how she's a quiet, introverted, she's spending a lot of time putting puzzles together. But so in many ways, her quiet sort of nature is very much like her mother. But then like me, she's very opinionated and wants to sort of articulate herself sometimes. And so we're thinking about, okay, where is this going to take her? And then she's being shaped by this sort of era and time that it's a very interesting place, as you're saying about your 13-year-old daughter, for us to be raising young women. And So I can certainly appreciate what it is you were trying to accomplish there. Is that organization doing really well? Like, where are they at today? I can't imagine that you, it sounds like you've done a little bit of moving on, but you didn't, where are they at today?
They're doing well. Yeah, absolutely. So they are still around. So they're thriving and doing well. I'm proud.
Good. So we're going to talk about, we agreed that for the Rachel and Jason party this week, we were going to talk about the future of fundraising in the post-COVID economy. And I have no idea where you're going to take us. I didn't know where we were going to go in the last one, and I don't know where we're going to go today. So, and honestly, I haven't thought about this a whole lot. I've been working on a writing project, but I haven't been doing any sort of forecasting or, you know, where do I think this is going to go? So this may be the first time that I've had this discussion. Where do you think fundraising is going to, let's think 12 months from now. Where is fundraising going to be 12 months from now?
I think we're, well, so some obvious things. I think we're obviously going to see a rise in online giving, definitely, without a doubt. We will see an uptick in online giving as a consequence of this. Won't be the lion's share, but I would expect that we will see online giving to double the percentage that it is right now. We'll know this when, like, you know, Blackbaud finishes their report and releases it. But I definitely think we're going to see a big rise in online giving, more than we had before this crisis. Definitely a reduction in organizations who were very event dependent before. So we can say goodbye to the tyranny of events. We can say goodbye to the golf tournaments and a lot of those things that I think for many of organizations, that can be a really positive change, because we can reduce our dependency on events, because events are so intensive in terms of staff resources. But I think we'll see a lot of organizations pivot to moving into virtual events. And I think the biggest thing is really organizations who are leveraging this time right now to get to know their donors and deepen their relationships with their donors and talk to their donors. Those relationships will grow, and those relationships will really do so much to support those charities, and those gifts will grow. I think I'm seeing a lot of organizations being willing to be very nimble and be very innovative and use all kinds of different strategies to connect with donors. I've seen some really great examples of organizations that were, you know, they had stuff that they'd wanted to do and they never had the time to do it. And they've leveraged this as, hey, let's finally do that. Let's finally launch that. So I've seen some great organizations launch a lot of great stewardship programs for donors that they didn't seem to have time to do before, but now they are. And I'm seeing their donors loving it, and it's having a really positive impact. I'm seeing a ton of innovation out there. I mean, a ton of innovation. I'm seeing a ton of behind the scenes slice of life, with people being real and people being authentic, and people, I'm seeing some organizations that are using humor and just, you know, being brave about showing up in the ways that they show up for their donors. And I think that that's something that donors are really, really responding to. And I hope that that will, and I predict that that will have a lasting change. And we won't go back to just business as usual, but we'll stay in this place of being more genuine and being more authentic and being more vulnerable with our donors and with our constituents.
Yeah. You know, so Rachel, I think a lot of us, I've got two of her books sitting right here in front of me, Brené Brown's stuff, and you guys certainly appreciate her stuff, and because you guys are from the great state of Texas. She's down in Houston. But is some of this idea of vulnerability that Brené Brown has really been sort of bringing to the forefront really going to sort of go to another level in your mind because of COVID-19? And we're going to be more vulnerable, more authentic, more transparent, and very, you know, transparent is going to sort of stop being sort of this buzz phrase about how we present our 990, but we're actually going to be transparent about what we're nervous about or fearful of and that sort of stuff.
Yes. And I think that organizations that weren't willing to be vulnerable, they will either learn from organizations who are, or they will suffer the consequences, because this is the time to be real and authentic. And this is the time to show your donors that you care. And this is the time to really have those conversations with donors and call your donors and check on your donors and check on them frequently and talk with them openly about how they are and how they're doing. And I think that for organizations that do that, those relationships will deepen and be very satisfying and very meaningful and ultimately very lucrative. And organizations who aren't willing to be that vulnerable, they just won't. This is the time. Like, this is the time to move a transactional relationship into a deep and lasting relationship with a donor. But it takes you being willing to have those conversations. So organizations that are afraid of doing that won't see that success.
Is that a different type of leader? I mean, is that, because I think it's one thing for you and I to be talking to, like in the last broadcast, we were talking about the fundraiser who's 2 years in, but what we're talking about with an organization that's more transparent, more authentic, more vulnerable is really about the boss that person's working for. And even more so than that, it's the board that boss is working for.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I think this is really where we're going to see a lot of change in the nonprofit sector. So I feel like organizations that embrace fundraising and that embrace relationships and that have a culture of, a culture of philanthropy, where they realize that fundraising is how we fulfill our mission and that we embrace the role that our donors play in supporting our cause and making that happen, those organizations are going to grow and those organizations are going to thrive. And I think organizations that treat their donors as, a means to an end and don't have, have more transactional relationships with their donors, they're missing an opportunity here to connect with their donors like they haven't before. I'm encouraging fundraisers on the importance of fundraising right now and not stopping in a crisis, but ramping up in a crisis with their fundraising. And I think that, and I coach fundraisers a lot on overcoming the naysayers who may be within their organization or within their board around fundraising. We're still experiencing record giving. And so this is a time to be, building those relationships with your donors.
Is the idea of authenticity a year out, and the idea that, for example, we're not going to be, let's say, for instance, we've canceled the gala or the golf tournament or something. Where is that playing out? Let me frame this up a little better. So I've become a really big fan with my clients of these Jeffersonian sort of small type intimate sort of dinner parties and those sorts of things. Do you think some of that authenticity is going to sort of play out, not in sort of this complete abandonment of events, but maybe like this smaller scale. And I even think about this in the context of like professional development. So you and I were talking earlier about some of the things that we've done with some of the trainings that you and I have been a part of. I think about the roadshow that we do at Responsive. And I'm thinking that some of these large scale events may give way to smaller intimate gatherings where there's 25 or 35 people in the room.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned Jeffersonian dinners. I'm a huge fan of Jeffersonian dinners, and I think they're really, really fantastic. I feel like this is a really big shift that we're seeing in for organizations in being really nimble and in moving stuff from the masses to creating those connections. And I tell organizations, like, what was on your bucket list of stuff that, like, what is your opportunity in this pandemic to do something innovative that you haven't done before? Maybe something that you've always wanted before. Maybe it's stewardship. Maybe it's, I had one organization did this awesome Feel Good Friday where they just started sending out these emails every Friday, and it's just a success that the donor made possible. And it's just pure happiness and joy in the donor's inbox. And it was just one of those things that they meant to get to before, but they just didn't have the time. And this pandemic allowed them the creativity and the opportunity to do that. Another thing that I've been telling organizations right now is this is a great time for storytelling. What are the stories of, you know, like YMCA, for example. Everyone has a Y story. Maybe it was their parents taking them to the Y to learn to swim. Maybe it was them taking their kids to the Y to learn how to swim. But everyone has a story. And this is a really great time for you to be collecting those stories and using those stories to deeper connect your donors to your cause, or spotlight those stories to make the case for your organization. So I'm really excited by some of the stories that I'm seeing now, from slice of life stories to just, you know, great stories where people are coming forward and talking about how the organization impacted their life. And this could be a great opportunity for you to be out there collecting those stories.
I'm reading a book right now, Rachel, called, and you may have picked this up yourself. It's called The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters, by Priya Parker. And in that book, she's talking about, she doesn't reference Jeffersonian dinners, but she's essentially, in some ways, she's very much advocating for them indirectly. But the first thing she talks about in terms of like these events that we've historically done, is she says you really have to sort of examine, you know, why you do these things. Like, do you even really understand? Have you even examined the purpose for which you were carrying these things out? And she sort of interrogates this notion that in some cases, and she's not speaking directly or specifically to fundraising, but sometimes there's so many overlapping purposes. And so we end up muddying the water as to why we're gathering in the first place, which is kind of where I'm getting at with my next question. Do you think there's going to be more clarity? So if we do host an event, large or small, what she would be arguing, and what I'm asking you is do you think there's going to be more clarity of purpose, like why we're doing it? And so rather than just trying to sort of cram a bunch of things into this big event where you got 400 people in the room, we're going to actually come together with more clarity and know exactly what we want to accomplish, and maybe even more ensure that the right people are in the room, for example.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an opportunity. I have been, you know, keeping track and watching events that were originally going to be in person going virtual. And I've been really watching these with such fascination around the rules are completely different, you know, and what worked for you before isn't going to work for you now. And how are you going to be prepared to be successful in, you know, and you're competing with you just don't have the captive audience sitting at a table drinking adult beverages when you're virtual. So how are you going to compensate for that? I think that we will see those things change profoundly. But it's really I think that ultimately this is all about connection. I mean, it isn't just like food and water and shelter that we need. Connection is one of the most basic psychological needs that we have as humans. And organizations have an opportunity to connect right now with their donors. And I feel like, I mean, I'm always the town crier for donor love. It's always important to me being donor centric, but I feel like now organizations who really embrace that have a super unique opportunity to deepen a relationship and provide a sense of comfort in a world that right now is full of great uncertainty.
Yeah, I think some of my, and I sort of in between the lines of maybe what you're saying there about donor love and donor centricity and those sorts of things, aren't we going to get to a sort of a place when you're using words like authenticity and vulnerability and stuff, those, the idea, for example, donor love really begin to mean something completely different than it has in the past. It becomes less of a laundry list of the ways to craft your appeal letter. And it actually becomes a way of sort of thinking about perhaps why I'm picking up the phone afterwards to acknowledge that gift and my willingness to sort of listen for a little bit longer on the telephone and those sorts of things. I mean, we're talking about a different, are we a year out from now, are we talking about a different fundraiser?
You mean like how fundraisers will permanently be changed from this?
Yeah. Yeah. Is the job description essentially changing? Are we less technical experts and are we more, you know, truly relationship builders in a much more meaningful way?
I would say absolutely so, because I really firmly believe that building relationships isn't optional in fundraising. It's inherent in what fundraising is. And I think that people who are not committed to having, you know, real relationships with donors, real authentic relationships where they know donors and they know what interests them and they know what their passions are and they know how they want to be significant and they care and thrive in those details. I think that fundraisers who aren't, I mean, yeah, you could run like a direct mail program and, you know, there's certainly many jobs that you could have in a nonprofit that don't specifically relate to that. But I feel like this is a real turning point where I feel like it's, if you are in fundraising, it's, you know, and you aren't interested in really building authentic relationships with people, this is where you realize this is not the job for me. This is where you have your come to Jesus moment from this crisis where you realize maybe there's something else that I'm more passionate about doing, because I think that is the deciding factor that's going to determine which organizations walk out of this successfully and which don't.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to hear what you're saying, because I almost wonder, I've mentioned a couple of times, I'm working on this book and I've been researching some of these critiques of philanthropy that came out, I think, starting in like 2017, 2018. And there's been some authors that have been sort of critiquing very heavily and almost created a lot of divisiveness between the organizations, the causes, those who were serving and those who were doing the, you know, the benefactors, the people who are writing the big checks. And in some cases, it just seems very combative. And I almost wonder if some of these, some of the people who've sort of jumped on this bandwagon sort of could not, I mean, obviously none of us really could, but we did not anticipate something like COVID that would sort of drop in our lap after we've just sort of built these walls between us and our donors. And I just don't think that that's going to hold up. I think we're going to actually have to go the other way, to use some of this language you're suggesting, vulnerability and a willingness to listen and stuff. And possibly have to, it just seems so divisive sometimes, some of what's being said about the relationship between organizations and their benefactors.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So the last question, the question, I always promise sort of a curveball at the end of the, or at least two thirds in. And the question I want to ask you today, Rachel, are we going to be working for the same organ? And this is kind of the question I actually wanted to ask you in the last episode too, but are we going to be working for the same organizations a year from now? And what I mean by that is everything that's changed and everything that's going to be expected of these organizations in the future, is now the time for fundraisers to necessarily be examining, am I working for the right organization, or do I need to start looking for an organization that better aligns with where I see all this going?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think it's a very worthwhile question for fundraisers to be asking. I mean, I think crisis brings out the best and the worst in people. And I think there may be a lot of fundraisers, I mean, at least from the, what I see in my space, I see organizations all over the map. I mean, I see organizations who have invested in fundraising and who are not missing a beat and are getting out there and being innovative and being donor centric and sending lots of appeals and raising more money than they've ever raised before and building deeper relationships than they've ever had before with their donors, and are frankly having a great time doing it because they're willing to take risk and see reward and experiment, and they thrive on all of those things. And I'm also seeing organizations who are, you know, it's like paralyzed with fear and have naysayers. Maybe it's board members, maybe it's a CEO. Oh, we'd be insensitive to fundraise now. We can't possibly do that. Or they're fundraising, but they can't really reimagine themselves and their services in a different context. And I think that this pandemic is really requiring that all of us do that. And I think that we will look very differently. And I would say that if you're facing uphill battles for fundraising, there are so many organizations. I mean, fundraisers are in short demand. They're in very high demand. And I would say that's one of the luxuries about fundraising is that there's far greater need than there are fundraisers to do the work. So if you're in a situation where the leadership and the culture is one that is corrosive to fundraising or in opposition to fundraising, there are lots of organizations that would love to have you. I have seen a lot of great fundraisers face undue burdens and obstacles in doing the great work that they were hired to do. And that always breaks my fundraising heart. But right. I know that there are lots of organizations out there that would love to have those fundraisers work for them. And to all the leaders out there, you know, this is your time to embrace innovation and risk and trying new things. This is a time and an opportunity to do that. And I hope that the listeners out there that are tuning in will take advantage of that.
So it's sort of like these authors I was talking about earlier that were sort of, defending the way they in their mind should do, how philanthropy should be working. Is now a time for fundraisers to sort of rise up and sort of defend what they know to be the right way to do things? And in some ways, I remember doing some research for my previous book, this along the lines of how nurses in healthcare, one of the things that we know in healthcare is that nurses are oftentimes a really good barometer of how well we take care of patients. And at times I kind of wonder if fundraisers really need to step up to the plate and say that the degree to which you understand me and the work that I'm here to do is also the degree to which you're going to understand how to take care of your donors. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, if they don't treat their fundraisers well and appreciate, I mean, I'm remembering one of my favorite fundraisers who was a great mentor to me, and it was shocking, but his boss wanted him to be at his desk like from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. every single day.
Yeah, and good luck.
that's not what fundraising is. I mean, it isn't like a glamorous string of cocktail parties and luncheons. There's a lot of behind the scenes rigor, but it's about building relationships, and you need to be outside of your desk in order to build relationships. I think that if they don't treat the fundraiser well, that's unlikely that they are going to treat the donors well. And sadly, it's unlikely that those organizations will survive. I mean, I think that there will be very serious fallout from this crisis. And I predict that those who won't survive it are those organizations who were ambivalent or not completely invested in building donor relationships and supporting their fundraisers and taking on risk and being willing to ask for help and ask for help frequently and ask for help in real and authentic ways. You know, the only way to make sure that you don't receive is to not ask. And so ask early, ask often. And this is not the time to throw great fundraising practices out the window. This is the time to really double down on them.
Rachel, I imagine that there are some people that have listened to our conversation today and they're thinking, I'd really like to reach out to Rachel and have a conversation with her. Let's imagine it's that person who's 5 years into their career and they don't want to reach out to a maverick rabble rouser like myself, but they want to talk to a very level-headed, brilliant individual like yourself. How would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah, thanks. Visit my website. It's rachelmuir.com, rachelmuir.com. You can book a appointment with me if you want to talk more on my website. I've got oodles of resources up there, including stewardship plans and guides for getting the visit and nailing the ask and how to get your board more involved in fundraising and everything in between. I've also got like a subscription program where I do training every month. So there's lots of different ways to get involved with me. And there's lots of resources to help you with your fundraising for free up there on my website.
Rachel, if somebody goes to your website and they're like, there's like a go-to resource, which what would you like them to look for first?
One is join me. One is rachelmuir.com/join. And that's where you can find out more about the programs that I have. And another one is rachelmuir.com/guides. And I literally have all of my white papers and downloads and resources up there. So you can access all of them there.
Sounds like some really great stuff, Rachel. You're always welcome back. It's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.